Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is James Fallows, who reads from and discusses the paperback edition of his provocative book, Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq, published by Vintage. In the weeks to come, we have Rick Riley, Augustine Burroughs, Madeline Albright, Elizabeth Berg, Nando Parado, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, thank you all for coming out this evening. It's a real pleasure to be here. I was at the Tattered Cover years ago at a different location, but it's very nice to see how the ambiance has been preserved or recreated in a new venue, so it's great to be here. I thought that what would be most appropriate in this kind of venue would be a relatively informal discussion and also a relatively brief one, so we have time for some questions. In token of my informality, I'll first take off my jacket, and then I will... sleeves, signifying the will to work. Even though the magazine is 150 years old, I'm about that old myself. I will try to maintain some vigor for the next while. I feel as if I have to add footnotes to a couple of the introductory comments you heard. I always sort of shrink when I hear the U.S. news period mentioned. That's what I think of as the dark years, the lost years. But there was one thing I tried very hard to do during the two-plus years I was there. The college rankings, as you know, and we can talk about this later if you want, are the staple of U.S. news' business. And I was trying very hard to reform them because they could not be eliminated. They are what keeps the magazine going. And so it was fascinating to see from the inside all the little tricks and jigsaws and crowbars and the rest that had been applied to make them turn out the way they did. And so I tried to apply various sorts of truth squads to them. One result was that the rankings that came out just after my disappearance from the editorship, which was occasioned by a disagreement between owner and editor, and you know how those go, was that Caltech, which is previously like number 17, became number one the following year. Any of you who are Caltech alums, I can explain to you later how that happened, why it plummeted number 17 the year after that again. I then I need also to annotate the time at Microsoft, which immediately followed my time at U.S. News, my disappearance from U.S. News. I'd always been interested in software, been interested in how you could make tools for thinking, and so I made a deal with Microsoft that if they were producing the more or less monopoly tool for writers, i.e. Word, it should be better than it was, and it should be good for actual writing. So I embedded myself in the Word design team, which was a wonderful experience. And it had one high road consequence, sort of. If any of you have seen Microsoft's program called OneNote, which actually is, I think, the most interesting program they put out now. That's something I feel some vague parental pride for. I was part of getting that going. The more practical thing I accomplished was, do you remember you type Dear Joe and something pops up saying, hey, it looks like you're writing a letter, and you want to just punch the screen? That's now turned off by default. And I am the guy who did that. So we all have things that mark our passage through life, and I fear that's going to be mine. My final annotation to the intro is that I've in the last week or so, I have tried to tool up my website and put in little thoughts as I travel the world. And if any of you believe the parable of the boiled frog, that is, you throw a frog into a pot of water and it will jump out, but you raise the heat slowly and it will sit there, that's actually not true. And I have all the evidence for why it's not true. So you can go there when we are done. So those are all the annotations. Or you can ask me, and I'll tell you too. And one hint I'll give you is I commissioned an article, a research article for this when I was at U.S. News, and the research was all done in Mexico as opposed to within the United States. Details to come later. Here is the plan I thought I would have for the next few minutes before entertaining your questions. I've been back in the U.S. now from Shanghai, where I moved about 2 months ago, and expect to spend the next 2 years for 5 or 6 days. And I've been in a couple of other venues like this, talking about the state of American foreign policy and the state of the war in Iraq and potential wars in Iran. And I found myself in a very strange circumstance. Given the nature of American politics now, most people who would take the trouble to appear at a gathering like this, and I'm very grateful for you, are in various ways unhappy with the direction of American foreign policy. And I found myself often the right-wing person in the room because I feel somewhat, because since my assigned role in life is that of reporter and journalist and somebody trying to find out what's going on in various places and explain it, as opposed to political activist or organizer or campaign advisor in the elections that are coming up this fall and the ones 2 years from now, I often feel as if I've somehow let people down in not giving them red meat and saying, you know, it's time for war crimes trials, it's time for impeachment, it's time for everything else. What I will try to do is offer, and therefore I feel as if I need to offer a kind of apologia for the craft that I and my colleagues are trying to carry out at the Atlantic, and how what we're doing, both month by month and what I've tried to present in this book, its role in politics and how I hope it provides some new information for people from a variety of perspectives, and how it does one particular thing that's become more and more difficult for the media. And I'll come back to this later. Trends in the media, including those I described 10 years ago in a book called Breaking the News, have given us a more and more sort of balkanized information geography. People have their own places where they get not simply opinions, but also facts. It's very difficult now for people to have overlapping sets of facts, or to say, let's all agree that 1 + 1 equals a certain sum. We can agree what the sum of 1 + 1 is. And we actually think our mission at our magazine, 150 years in, is to try to be as authoritative and fair as we can be, to sort of show you our homework. Here's the people we talked to, here's what they said, here are the dissenting points of view. And it's with that spirit that I've tried to do the work I have in the last 5 years, which I'll tell you about now. The conclusion that it's led me to is a sort of red meat conclusion. And I mentioned in one of the articles that's included in this book that I convened about a year ago a number of military officials and intelligence officials and others whom I'd come very much to trust over the preceding 3 or 4 years, and I had a discussion with them putting today's foreign policy in perspective. And pretty soon the room was divided into two camps. And the camps were, one group of people thought the invasion of Iraq was the worst mistake the United States had made since Vietnam. The opposing view was that it was the worst mistake ever. You know, those were sort of the two poles of the argument. And these were colonels in the Air Force, and they were Marine Corps strategists, and there was that was the pole of the argument. So you can see where I am coming from. And in an analytical way, I think it's now hard to rebut the case that the current administration has been the most destructive in American history, if you combine the economic impact, you know, both fiscal and international, the sort of, you know, comity within the nation impact and the international impact. My previous champion for this title had been James Buchanan, you know, sort of sleeping as the Civil War came on. But I think it's just analytically, as opposed to red meat-wise, I think there's a very strong case to make in that regard. So that's my apologia. Now a brief three-part presentation, a three-part informal presentation. I'm going to say a little more about craft and what the way a magazine like ours and a writer like me tries to approach a series of events like those the U.S. has been through over the last 5 years, and what I think is effective about our approach and what we might try to do better, and it explains what I'm doing in this book. Second, I'm going to do a very brief kind of touching on the main points of today's news, i.e. Iran, Iraq, and the global war on terror. And then third, I'm going to give you a list of the things which stick in my mind as the really hard questions to try to answer in the long run, things that we can't know the answers to now, which are worth thinking about in the future. So that's the plan. This will take me maybe 15 minutes or so if I talk really fast, and then we can have chances for questions. First, a mention of craft. Those of you who already have the joy of possessing this book, and those of all the rest of you who anticipate this joy, will see on the second or third page says, for Cullen Murphy. Cullen Murphy, I don't know if any of you have heard of him. He's a very good writer of very droll, informed commentary. More important to me, for 20 years, from 1985 until 2005, the end of last year, he was the managing editor of the Atlantic Monthly. And he is the person with whom I have worked most closely in trying to match the things our magazine can do with the particular constraints a monthly magazine works under. And what I'd like you to focus on for a moment, and I'll come back to Cullen, is how difficult it is to have to put together a monthly magazine. We have a much longer lead time than you can imagine. Even if we could go to press the instant before an issue went on the newsstands or came to your mailbox, the issue is out there for a month. So even in ideal circumstances, the news would be a month old, by the end of the cycle. And in fact, there's 2 or 3 months of production deadlines and distribution and all the rest. And when you come to the kind of reporting we try to do and the fact-checking and the editing, it's about 8 or 9 months from the time we have to think of an article to when it appears on the newsstand or in somebody's mailbox. And it's much harder than you might think to say, okay, next March or April, what's going to be interesting to people? And we're working on the March issue of the magazine right now. I'm writing an article for the March issue. We don't know who's going to control the Congress. We don't know what's going to happen in Iraq. We don't know anything else. And trying to match that challenge, doing things the rest of the media won't get around to, is the particular genius of this man, Cullen Murphy, who I mentioned. And it was discussions with him starting really on the, over the years, but starting especially on September 11th, 2001, which have kept me going over the last 5 years. On September 11th, 2001, I was in Washington, D.C., where I had moved the previous afternoon. The previous afternoon, my wife and I had come. We'd spent the previous 3 years in Seattle and Berkeley in the West Coast and gone back to D.C. And on September 11, 2001, no phones, no cell phones in D.C., so I was walking around watching the Pentagon burn and just seeing what was happening downtown. When I finally reached Cullen and Michael Kelly, then our editor, who, as you know, was killed in Iraq as the first American journalist killed there, The combined resolve they had was that even though our magazine was very slow, had these long lead times, we would find some way to cover in a distinctive fashion whatever new chapter was beginning in American history and world history. And I think through William Langewisch's reporting on the reconstruction of the World Trade Center and Robert Kaplan in Fallujah and other things we've done, I think we have. It's been a very strong era for our magazine. But what my assignment was to cover sort of the policy side of whatever was beginning on September 11th, the D.C. side of the story. And it's worth, I think, distinguishing the kinds of things you can do if you suffer under this lead time handicap. And you know that if any given moment, if the New York Times decided to do something, they could squash you because they could send 40 reporters to do it and they could publish it within a week, and so you would have a hard time. And conceptually, the two sorts of journalism one can do in our circumstance, excuse me a second here, are what I think of as anticipatory journalism and reconstructive journalism. And I have a long new introduction to this book, sort of explaining how in the evolution of journalism these kinds of articles work. Anticipatory journalism is trying to say, if we look down the track and think what is going to occur that other people won't get around to asking, then let's try to get on that bandwagon. And there's several illustrations of that are presented in this book. The one that I worked hardest on is one that was called The 51st State. And this was in March of 2002. The U.S. still at war in Afghanistan. No official discussion whatsoever about going to war in Iraq. Cullen Murphy and Mike Kelly told me that really that we all would place a major bet on the fact that war was going to happen during the next year, and certainly the U.S. would win if it conquered Iraq. Question is, what happens then? Let's try to think about what would happen after the U.S. Occupied the territory of Iraq. So I spent a couple of months interviewing everybody who had ever run any kind of occupation anyplace. And I won't go through all the chapter and verse of what they were saying, except to say that it was horrifyingly prescient and accurate, the things they foresaw, with one exception. The one exception was almost all these people thought there were going to be huge refugee flows that the U.S. would have to cope with. The reason that didn't occur is that what was supposed to trigger these refugee flows was the use of WMD. a chemical attack, a nuclear, a dirty bomb or something, that would get the refugees flowing, and for reasons you understand, that didn't occur. So that was one, that was the anticipatory journalism that we tried hardest to do. We also have did one that also was lead time motivated. The December 2004 issue of the Atlantic Monthly was a particular horror for us in this way. It went to press in the beginning of October of 2004, when we didn't know who was going to be the next president, and it came out right after the election. So we had to go to press not knowing if it would be a second Bush or a first Kerry, and we thought, what's going to be the problem either of these guys would have? And the answer was Iran. So we tried to go through a war game exercise of would it work to militarily prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. And our conclusion was that it wouldn't work. Apart from any other consideration, you just couldn't do it. And I'll give you more details there. So one category is anticipatory journalism. And it's interesting to think about why there isn't more of this in the U.S. press. And I talk some about that in the revised version of the book. The other thing that we have tried to do at the magazine is reconstructive journalism. You know that something happened, but you don't know exactly why. And going out and finding exactly why something occurred there is some value there for book writers and for magazines like ours. I'll mention quickly two of the efforts of reconstructive journalism, which I worked very hard. One was something called Blind into Baghdad, an article with the same title as this book. And the news that I think I was able to break in doing that story is that as you looked and saw all the difficulties of the occupation, you said, why didn't they think about these things? Why didn't they think about the looting? Why didn't they think about the power plants and all the rest? It was fascinating to find out that actually the U.S. government itself had done elaborate and wonderful foresighted exercises about what to expect. You know, the little piddling things I was able to find out as one journalist, of course, had been matched by huge institutional efforts which were superb in their foresight, and yet somehow the gears didn't connect at the top level. And that is a question still to be examined of why exactly the gears didn't connect, but I go into it somewhat. The other is an examination of a question I think historically will be looked at for a long time, which is how exactly the need to respond to the 9/11 attacks became the need to invade Iraq. You know, and that happened during the course of 2002. I have a scenario here that I won't bother to read you right now, sort of contrasting the beginning and the end of 2002 and how the world was just transformed. The beginning of 2002, the U.S. was popular around the world. There had been no substantial criticism by any major Islamic leader in the world of the U.S. campaign in Afghanistan at that point. By the end of 2002, it was quite different. So how we went from fighting terrorism to invading Iraq, I tried to look into. So those are the kinds – my point about craft is as the American media become more balkanized, more niche-ized, more opinionized, more JonBenet Ramsey, whipsawed, you know, you name it, I think that all that one can do as a reader and citizen is find the superb material that is out there. And for the motivated reader or viewer, this is the golden age. You can find out anything you want on the internet or in books or magazines. And for people who are in the business, in the media, all that you can do is try your best and put the best you can out there. And we have all this has been to explain what we've been trying to do and give people information about how things have happened and what conclusions we should draw. So that's what I have to say about craft. Let me say something about now current events and then some questions. Obviously, on each of these topics, Iraq, Iran, and the global war on terror, we could have a two-day seminar on each of those. Let me say about 1 minute's worth on each of them and then invite some – I'll expect questions later on. On Iraq, apart from everything else about Iraq – to my mind, the central, both intellectual and political point for the U.S. to grasp is simply there are no good next steps for the United States. None of them are good. And as soon as anybody proposes a plan, people can say that plan is bad. And yes, they all are bad. And I will offer a little plan for you. It's bad, and any retort you have is going to be bad too. There is the Colin Powell famous story of the Pottery Barn analogy. You break it, you bought it. I think the more relevant one is the analogy of somebody getting a hammer, busting up pottery, giving you the hammer and say, okay, what's your plan? You know, that's sort of the situation we're in. There's no good plan. I think part of the substratum of why there are no good plans is a combination of two dilemmas. One dilemma is the U.S. can't stay and the U.S. can't go. It can't stay for reasons that are obvious to all of us. Can't stay for domestic reasons, for reasons in Iraq, for the strain on the military, which is profound. It also, to the best of my immediate knowledge, can't go immediately. And what I mean by that is the horrific situation in Iraq now is the civilian violence day by day. And my best factual information is that at least in the short term, that would get even worse if the U.S. weren't there immediately. Now, the long term is a different question. So the dilemma of we can't go and we can't stay is a problem. There's another dilemma, which is you can't really have deadlines and timelines because they're not so good in negotiation that other people, you know, will run out the clock. On the other hand, everybody knows there is a deadline. There is a timeline. And the timeline is January 20th, 2009, essentially, that the Bush administration has made clear that it will not tolerate anything that looks like being pushed out of Iraq. At the same time, we know that whoever is the next administration, you name it, you know, Frist, Mitt Romney, Al Gore, whoever, is going to be getting out of Iraq. And so we have the need to sort of find something, you know, you don't want to negotiate with a deadline, but there is this real-world deadline, and finding a way to make the next 2+ years when the administration will not tolerate appearing to be forced out of Iraq, that's what conditions all the bad plans. Actually, I won't give you my bad plan until you ask for it later on. I'll just say that there aren't any good ones. I'll wait to have some offers for you. And if you ask me, I'll give you my bad plan. Second, Iran. Let's think about the sort of chain of logic or the chain of questions about Iran and then predict current events. Does Iran want a nuclear weapon? Of course they want a nuclear weapon. You know, any of us, if we were governors of Iran, we would want a nuclear weapon. Iran thinks of itself as a great power, as Persia. Also, as Iran surveys the world, the difference between North Korea and Iraq is that North Korea can't be invaded because it has nuclear weapons. And Iraq could be invaded because it didn't have nuclear weapons. So, of course, Iran wants it. That's question one. Of course they want one. Question two, would it be bad if they got one? Yes. It's bad because each nation that gets a nuclear weapon makes it that much harder to prevent any others from getting them. It would be destabilizing with Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Turkey and all the rest. So, yes, it would be bad if they got one, and with Israel, too. Third, is there a way the U.S. can force them not to develop a nuclear weapon? I argue in this book, no. It's just not militarily feasible to prevent them from doing it. They've gone too far. They have too many other retaliatory options, especially in Iraq. We think Iraq is bad now. Iran has been relatively playing nice in Iraq until now, and that could change. So is there any other way they might be prevented? I think potentially yes. This is the effort the Europeans are mainly leading to have a combination of threats and rewards that make it worth Iran's while to delay or deviate. And I think that really deserves a lot of support from the U.S. and also pressuring the Chinese to join in. And the final question in the sequence is, if that doesn't work, what are we left with? And I think we are left with the bad option of living with Iran with nuclear weapons and relying on deterrence as we do with Pakistan and with India and with China and the rest. It's a bad option, but the ways to, unless we can strike the grand bargain, the ways to prevent it are worse. Is the U.S. going to nonetheless attack Iran? Nobody can know for sure. My friend Seymour Hersh, who I respect greatly, has argued that really there are plans afoot in the Bush administration. My instincts and reporting suggest that the U.S. is not actually going to attack Iran because the U.S. military is so dead set against it. The U.S. military recognizes it would be a disaster for them. And let me put it a different way. So I think there is bluff going on now from the administration that they're playing Richard Nixon's crazy man game, where if the other side thinks you're capable of anything, they're more likely to negotiate. If I am wrong and they actually do attack, I will join the red meat crowd because that would be so recklessly wrong and self-defeating a measure that I can hardly countenance. So that's, I don't think they're going to do it, and if they did, that would be a radical step towards irrational behavior, and we'll see what to do then. Third, global war on terror. I had an article in the last issue of the Atlantic Monthly called We Win. Its argument essentially was the time had come to declare the global war on terror successfully completed so that we could do the effective steps of actually defending ourselves against terrorist attack in the long run. I won't recapitulate the whole argument, but I'll say I think the Democrats, well, I won't say make it politically. The analytical point I was making is I interviewed a whole lot of experts on terrorism and international security, and they had two very surprising things that I hadn't expected, what they're saying. One is that the group that actually attacked the U.S., Al-Qaeda Central, has been pretty badly hurt in the last 4 or 5 years. You know, we know that Osama bin Laden got away at Tora Bora, but it's also the case they can't have training camps of the same dimension, they can't meet, they can't transfer money, they can't use cell phones, and most people said they can't organize a sort of vast effort like 9/11 anymore. So anything is possible, but most experts think it's not likely that we could have any kind of huge event again. So on the other hand, for reasons that involve Iraq and lots of other things, the threat of Islamic extremism will be with us for quite a while from the so-called local self-starter groups. And the counterpart argument, which also impressed me, was we can fight them best if we say the war is over and now we're going to use all these effective means to control them, as the British have done in breaking that airline plot. I won't say anything more. If you ask me more, I'll give you more of the pitch. It's interesting how fearful the Democrats are of saying anything like this, because they're trying to sort of out-terrorize Republicans, mainly say, oh, you haven't defended the ports. You know, what about that? And yes, that's true. But it's the cultural point I'd make here is that in the last 5 years, the United States has not been behaving like itself. When I think of American symbols in the world, you know, the U.S. thinks of the world through its movie stars, and yet a lot of them are shoot-em-up people like Arnold Schwarzenegger, the outside world's vision of the president of America. But it's really, think of people like Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca, or Gary Cooper, or Jimmy Stewart, or even Clint Eastwood, or even Harrison Ford, and you can tell me the right female counterpart for these people who are tough and do business but are not panicky. And I'm not running around saying it's, oh, code red. And it's not saying, oh, let's take off all of our clothes before we get onto the airplane and let's make sure we don't have any coffee on the airplane. Think even of Ronald Reagan. When Ronald Reagan was shot, the first thing he said when he came to was not, let's lock down Washington so this never happens again. You know, what he said to his wife was, honey, I forgot to duck. And again, it's, you might not agree with Reagan's policies, or you might too, but that was part of American culture that he was reflecting. So I think it is not the right part of American culture to have the crawl at the bottom of Fox News saying terror alert, you know, elevated. Until very recently, the freeways in Washington, D.C., the flashing signs, they'd either say major delay on 495 South, or else they would say report suspicious activity. This is what you'd see when you're driving around, and just that's not the American way. Finally and briefly, let me mention a couple of questions I think are interesting, and then I'll be happy to talk about some questions. Talk about your questions. Here's one question that we'll ever be able to answer for sure, but it's a serious question. That question is, in principle, could it have worked? And by it, I mean the effort to transform the Middle East by democratizing Iraq through force of arms. This was, in my view, the main reason for the war, the sense that you really would, the Paul Wolfowitz type argument, you could really transform the Arab Islamic world by getting rid of Saddam Hussein and creating a democracy. Could that possibly have worked? You can think of circumstances in which it might, but as soon as you think of those, you realize why those were almost impossible. Having a big enough invasion force, a big enough coalition, where you'd have lots of Arabic countries involved and lots of Islamic countries and lots of Arabic-speaking countries that would be involved. Having enough preparation that you would make sure you wouldn't have the looting and you wouldn't have the sectarian violence, you wouldn't have all these other things, and just a long, foresighted preparation. Having a clear enough explanation for why you were doing this, there'd be no real questioning of your legitimacy, as there was not really about Afghanistan and not about the first Gulf War. So you can conceive maybe that this might have worked, but it seems to me so vanishingly remote a possibility. It's like saying, well, I don't have the right analogy, but you can't base foreign policy on that kind of chance in a million or chance in a thousand. So in practical terms, my view is it could not have worked, but I think people will be discussing this for a long time. A second question that I think we'll get some answers to as the administration changes and people are freer to talk and the equivalent of the movie The Fog of War is done about Wolfowitz or Rumsfeld, this question will be, if success in Iraq was so important to this administration, and it was the foundation of their foreign policy and the vision of the world, why were they so half-assed about it? You know, why did they do it so sloppily and so cavalierly? Why did they ignore all the planning? Why did they do it with their eyes closed? We don't know the answers. There are lots of hypotheses I examine in this book. I'll mention just one of them, which I think is not an obvious one, but I think is a powerful one. If you think of occupations that were a big mess, like Somalia, scene of Black Hawk Down, or much of the Balkans and Kosovo, what they had in common is they were under the Democrats. They were under Bill Clinton. And I think it actually was an articulated view by a lot of the administration's leaders that the weakness and vacillation and flip-flopping of the Democrats invited this kind of chaos. It's because they were weak, because they didn't lay down a clear line, that they had trouble occupying countries. And if you think back to transformations that worked well, the fall of the Soviet Union, the reemergence of the Czech Republic and of Poland and of Russia in its own way, they happened under Ronald Reagan and the first George Bush. And I think there was a sense that we know how to do these things, the conservative leadership team, and that I think in his soul, Paul Wolfowitz thought that Iraq was going to be like the Czech Republic. You get rid of the people at the top, and then you have a basically prosperous country that will be able to prosper again and will help all its neighbors. There are a lot of other reasons, too, but I think that was one of the factors. I thought it was going to be 100 times easier than it was. Recall that 2 weeks before the invasion, Wolfowitz said to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, it is impossible to imagine that governing Iraq or occupying Iraq could be harder than conquering it. You know, which, you know, it's obvious that it would be more difficult, but it was impossible for them to imagine it. And that will have more answers. Two other brief, I have a whole long list of questions, but I'll just give you two others. One involves the connection between the military and the general public. We all know that if there had been a draft in the last 10 or 15 years, obviously there would never be, this war would not have happened, and young people would be engaged with it now in the way they aren't. Obviously there's not going to be a draft, and that's a separate topic. Query, how can the U.S. build in some kind of democratic feedback loop to its politics without a draft or without some other way to really involve citizens in the effect of the military actions? As a proportion of the population, the military is the smallest it's been about during the entire existence of the Atlantic Monthly. I mean, it's not quite true, but it's a tiny little fraction of the population. The military has been at war. The rest of us have not been at war. We haven't been there. We haven't paid taxes and all the rest. How can we have a sane and decent military policy under those circumstances? It's a hard question. I have one other question, which I was going to read a speech passage from Jimmy Carter, which is particularly dear to me because I wrote it myself. But I will spare you that. It has to do with the extremes of U.S. foreign policy. American foreign policy is harder than most countries because it goes back and it has to involve both idealism, because that's who we are, and practicality, because we're a real nation too. We have to balance our budget. We have to do everything else. Usually we've gone from extreme to extreme. The idealism of Woodrow Wilson followed by the isolation years. The idealism in its way that led to Vietnam followed by a tragic after effect of Vietnam, which is the U.S. could not intervene to prevent the Cambodian genocide because we just simply couldn't send troops to Southeast Asia again after the Vietnam War. Query, what's going to happen next? What will be the other swing of the pendulum after the consequences of a theoretical exercise that's taken us into Iraq? So those are some of the questions that are interesting to me. On request, you can get the passage from Carter's speech, you can get my bad plan, you can get whatever else, or you can get an answer to some other question that you might offer. So I hope you will find this book valuable if you read it, because I try to put all this together from the perspective of hindsight, what we know differently than I knew when I was writing them. And that's my informal opening pitch. So thank you, and I'll be happy to hear your questions. Oh, sorry. Yes. Yes. Well, I hope, for one thing, I'm around still to write, and I hope the magazine is around too. I think that's a very, very good question, because there's so many strands that you can only see leading to trouble one sort or another. One story will be what happened to Israel. You know, how Israel was not able to sort of contain all the contradictions of its own experience. You know, there are all sorts of dilemmas for Israel. It can be either a democracy or a Jewish state, but it can't be both in the long run, the way that its demographics are set up. And so, and I believe that its last 3 or 4 months of dealings in Lebanon have been really short-sighted and really destructive. So trying to write about, I fear the analysis will be what happened to Israel, and whether that means whether Israel had some huge political breakdown or had a geographic breakdown or whatever, that would be one thing. What happened to the oil kingdoms? I hope that 30 years from now there's going to be some different energy basis for most of the world economy. And so these kingdoms of oil, what happened to them, I think we'll be writing about. And but I hope there would be a different kind of article, which is talking about how the Arab Middle East made it. You know, how the people used to say East Asia was destined to be impoverished forever and South America could never handle democracies, and those sweeping statements were undercut. And so if we're able to say how the Arab Middle East joined the modern world, that would be the good kind of anticipatory journalism. So, yes. It's question is whether the Arab rulers are supporting al-Qaeda someplace in luxury. The luxury part, I think, is probably not true. As best I don't know this in any firsthand way myself, but from interviewing people who are experts, they think that Osama bin Laden and Zawahiri are holed up someplace probably in Pakistan and not in luxury. You know, that they're in some, you know, living close to the ground and they can't communicate very easily. So first, luxury probably is not underway. Are many of these rulers supporting them directly? Probably not directly. Pakistan, in a way, is implicitly letting them live because Pakistan chooses not to patrol that part of its territory. Many other Arab countries are clearly tolerating extremism in general. You know, Saudi Arabia is the case that's most difficult for the U.S. and Syria in its own way. So the long-term struggle, which I try to talk about in this latest Atlantic article, is how to maximize the areas, how to divide America's opponents rather than unite them. You know, the classic divide and rule. We have united them, unfortunately, by talking in broad strokes about all Islamic fascism in ways that makes all Muslims get their back up and think that it's, even though it's not a holy war, somehow it doesn't involve them. And a much subtler way of trying to divide and conquer and win the friends we can in the Arab world and isolate the people we don't like, I think, is the longer-term strategy. So that's avoiding a direct answer, but it's the best I can do. I was trying to give a direct answer based on the limits of my knowledge. Yes, sir. This was one of my list of long-term questions I skipped over for reasons of time. You know, many institutions... and I should ask, should I stand closer or farther from this microphone just for feedback reasons? Closer. That many American institutions have been through a failure in the last period. Certainly, representative democracy has failed. The Democratic Party did not constitute opposition, even though there was opposition in the public. And that was a crass decision in the fall of 2002 not to oppose the war resolution because of the midterm election. So there's a failure of representative democracy. There's been a kind of failure of military professionalism. The military has been, in some ways, the hero of this whole era, and they are effectively the peace party now because they don't want to go into Iran. But many of the pathologies of Vietnam are repeating themselves, of having the very top level, the very, very top level of the military be yes men to the political leadership. Tommy Franks comes to mind. Richard Myers comes to mind. And unfortunately, Peter Pace, I think, as well, too. So there's been an institutional failure of the military, and they're very aware of the failure of honor and the failure of the press. And that failure of the press has many, many avenues to it. One strange reason for the failure, in my view, is the accident that the main attack, the main center of attack on 9/11 was also the city where the U.S. press is concentrated. You know, New York is the capital of the press, and the New York is where the most devastating attacks occurred. And so the liberal press was in a significant degree sort of radicalized to the right by having been in New York City. You know, that New York still has a different reaction from most of the rest of the world because it was personal and local for them, while it was for the country as well. And so there was a sense among many of the institutions that would normally have been much more aggressive that I think they were giving more of the benefit of the doubt to the administration they might otherwise have done. The New Yorker magazine had a pro-war editorial the week before the invasion, which it's hard to think. They didn't do that in the Vietnam War. And then there was the sort of accidental case as well of Judith Miller at the New York Times, where Howell Raines was then the editor, was sort of swinging for the fences with a lot of big stories, and she had big stories, and they turned out to be wrong, but they had a big impact. Then there's the other aspect of the media's performance, which is that over the last 20 or 25 years, the media have essentially, Americans have chosen their sources of information as they choose their neighborhoods and their restaurants and their schools and their fashions, and there isn't a central source of authority anymore. So in the run-up, there was no counterpart to the Walter Cronkite of my youth who could say, Vietnam was working, but it's not working anymore. And you had these partial fact zones. And it was there was, I think, a still uncontested study by the University of Maryland that as recent that in the month before the 2004 election, most Bush voters or most people who intended to vote for Bush believed that Iraq had caused 9/11 attacks. And most people who voted for Kerry believed that it hadn't. And so it wasn't different. It was differences of fact as much as differences of opinion. So I think there have been institutional failures almost everywhere you want to look, and I don't know what the institutional success would be. Does any of you have not? Well, here's one institutional success. Let me read you a paragraph that might surprise you. This is from this article I did called "The Lost Year," talking about how things stood at the beginning of 2002, how many things were going right for the United States. This talks about, at the beginning of 2002, the United States still operated in a climate of worldwide sympathy and solidarity. A broad range of allies supported its anti-Taliban efforts in Afghanistan, and virtually no international Muslim leaders had denounced them. President Bush was still being celebrated for his eloquent speech expressing American resolve before a joint session of Congress on September 20th. His deftness in managing domestic and international symbols was typified by his hosting an end of Ramadan ceremony at the White House in mid-December, even as battle raged on the Tora Bora region of Afghanistan. I think that there has been one institutional success, which is the United States has included its Islamic Muslim Americans have been still more included in the U.S. than has been the case in any other Western country. That's the one success. Most of the other institutions have some explaining to do, I think, and self-examination. Yes, sir?
Dick Cheney.
Dick Cheney. I was dumbfounded 2 weeks ago or so when Dick Cheney was asked, did you do anything differently? He said, no, we do exactly the same thing, even
Tim
if we
Russert.
Knew. Tim Russert. And that doesn't simply mean the WMD. That means we let the looting go on for a month, even though that was when things became irretrievable in Iraq. It means we'd still disband the army. We'd still leave the ammo dumps unguarded. You know, we'd still let the sectarian violence range. We'd still have Abu Ghraib. We'd still have Guantanamo. We'd do everything just the same way. The only way I could interpret that, my only interpretation is operational and cynical, which is sort of a poker bet, putting all the chips in the pot. You know, that the administration is going up or down with the war, so it might as well embrace it fully. So I think that was the policy. And President Bush, while he has expressed some second thoughts, he mainly, you know, he says he's going up or down with this war, so he might as well embrace it. Let me give you an anthropological lineup that I think explains maybe where we are. You know, so much of history really is chance. if Ralph Nader had gotten a bad cold in October of 2000, you know, he wouldn't have campaigned in Florida. You can think of any number of chances that are different. And I think the actual lineup of these characters, most of whom were involved in the first Gulf War when Bush's father was, you know, president and then victim of assassination plot, I mean, think of them, and only with this constellation could it work. You have the president who felt on 9/11 transformed in his mission. First, he imagined that he was Winston Churchill, you know, sort of drawing the line against Hitler. And I am sure, and I say this not cattily, he sees himself as Harry Truman now, the man who's making the big bet, and the population doesn't sympathize. Harry Truman left very unpopular, 24% approval rating, but he's been vindicated. And I'm sure that's how the president sees himself. And also, unlike Harry Truman, unlike any recent president, no curiosity about new information and no taste for the clash of views. I wrote 2 years ago, and still I've not been able to find any evidence that there was ever a meeting when Bush had his advisor say, let's talk over whether it makes sense to invade Iraq. Let's do the over-under on invading Iraq. What we'll gain, what we'll lose. That meeting never happened. You know, so it's personality of the president, number one. Personality of the vice president, whose views on life seem so dark and Spenglerian that he probably would think, you know, it's probably going to be a big mess in Iraq, but we'll worry about that after we get rid of this tyrant. You know, it's that's the Kenneth Edelman, who actually is a friend of mine. He became famous before the war for saying it was going to be a cakewalk, and he'd been a good friend of Cheney's and Rumsfeld's too. And he used to say before the war, "Yeah, it's going to be a mess, but we'll worry about that mess later." It would be like worrying about who would replace Hitler. You didn't care. You wanted to get rid of Hitler. So I think that probably was Cheney's point of view, and he was much more powerful over the president then. You have then also a national security advisor in this mix, Condoleezza Rice. She's been a good Secretary of State. I think she was terrible in that job, because her job was to – that job is to make sure the president has all the information he needs and that the different departments sort of work together, and those two things were signal failures. You have the Secretary of Defense. Is he a wise guy? Yes, he is. Does he answer questions straight? No, he does not. Was he willing to, you know this whole rap he has of just the rhetorical questions that he will answer. And he is not associated with this kind of regime change vision, but I think, he was not willing to challenge the administration, and he had the very destructive insistence on having a very small invasion force and all the rest. Wolfowitz, who in my view is the McNamara figure here, who must realize how badly things have turned out and actually thought it was going to work. And then who else do we have in the mix? I mean, that mixture of people. And Colin Powell. And Colin Powell, who knew what was happening and through a lifetime of obeying the chain of command honorably, obeyed the chain of command and made that fateful speech. The two people who could have stopped the war were Colin Powell and Tony Blair, and for different reasons that they didn't. So I think Cheney is now much less influential in the administration than he was before, but it was, you know, that was putting all the chips into the pot. We wouldn't do a single thing differently. Yes. There's lots of jobs that are hard in life. I mentioned that Colin Murphy had a hard job and thinking 8 months ahead, whoever's the next president is going to have a hard job in the United States. Trying to run Pakistan, now that would be a hard job. And I think that is a... probably if we're doing anticipatory journalism of another big nightmare to worry about, it would be when Pakistan falls apart, because it will fall apart with Islamic extremism and with nukes. And so that is, I hope that the administration is applying some foresighted thought to that. And probably for the meantime, they're just trying to be as nice to Musharraf as they can, you know, to avoid things falling apart. But I don't have any good answer to that, because you can't see a very positive outcome there, and you see lots of reasons why it might be in trouble. Did you have your hand up in the blue shirt? Yes. Yes. here's my bad plan. That the U.S. does everything it can to get out of there as quickly as possible, but it doesn't say so. And here's what I mean. Doing everything it can to get out of there means shifting every aspect of U.S. policy towards reducing the horrific level of civilian casualties day by day. You know, 100 people killed in bomb blasts and all the rest. And the way to do that is really to concentrate entirely on cleaning up the security forces and the police and the militias. The U.S. has said it's doing that, but it's not. And here is the clearest proof. The rotation schedules for U.S. troops are unchanged. An officer is there. He spends a year with a group. He starts to learn the language. He learns their personalities. And at the end of the year, he leaves. and then somebody else comes in. You can't run, you know, this kind of effort that way. So the U.S. does everything it can for an emergency effort to build up those forces so that the level of violence goes down and they're strong enough to let the U.S. get out of there, but we don't say so. Because as soon as you say that, number one, it's unacceptable to the Bush administration because you're being forced out. And number two, you set up that deadline and encourage the other side to wait you out. You don't want to have the deadline so people are waiting you out. So my bad plan is crash effort to bolster the local security forces, making everything different about the U.S., how the U.S. runs its military, but not saying, just saying that's what we're doing, not we're trying to get out of it. That's my plan. Yes. I guess I agree and disagree with the premise. I mean, I agree in the sense that, you know, it's still the case that in parts of the country you can't say the Civil War. You have to say the war between the states. You know, there are things where, that people just see differently in the long run. I think actually about Vietnam, which is now 30-plus years in the past, there's been much more sort of consensus on what happened and what didn't happen there than you would think. And it actually had been led by the U.S. military. The U.S. military, starting in the late 70s, went through a very impressive how-did-this-happen exercise. And I think they did a lot of very impressive introspection. And while you will still find some people of the Vietnam vintage, which includes me and some other people in the room who are still having these old battles like those over the Spanish Civil War, I think that is a generational thing, and it doesn't apply to people who are younger. So I think that after any traumatic episode, as Iraq has been, although much less traumatic than Vietnam for us, there are going to be entrenched and deeply held different points of view, and that's understandable. But I bet already it's the case that almost all sort of the professional literature, including within the military, says, you know, we really screwed up by letting this looting happen. And it really was a disaster to have the army be disbanded. Paul Bremer disagrees in his book, but basically everybody else says the same thing. So truth-telling is always difficult for emotional things where people see the truth so differently. And, yes, the parties will score points, but I bet you will not find – and some Republicans in 2008 will try to blame the Democrats for the problems in Iraq, but it's going to be a stretch. It's going to be a stretch to blame the Democrats for this war, I think. Yes, sir. Well, thanks for that question. I had two reasons for wanting to go to China. One is, in the 30 years I've worked for the Atlantic, I've spent about half the time in D.C. and half other places. I've tried to go back and forth. I like D.C. a lot, and I have a lot of friends there. We own a house there, and I like the subjects which are D.C.-centric. But it is a parochial place, and so I like being there for a couple of years, and I'd been there for the 5 years since the 9/11 attacks, and it was time to go elsewhere. So that was the push factor. The pull factor was that I, as you know, like you, I'd spent a lot of time in Asia in the 80s and early 90s and am really interested by its model of development, the sort of political content of its growth, the economic impacts of its growth. I was in China a lot 20 years ago and just wanted to see it again. So I have in mind a sort of series of articles for the Atlantics from China over the next 2 years. And while they have different sort of surface level subjects, the deeper questions obviously I'll be trying to get at are, can this last? What's it going to mean politically, you know, for the Chinese and for the rest of it? What's it going to mean environmentally? What will other developing countries make of the Chinese model? What it's going to mean militarily? And it's just a really interesting place to be right now. So it's just in this stage of life, I wanted the chance to be immersed in a new experience, and daily life in my apartment on Tomorrow Square in Shanghai qualifies. Yes, sir.
Since you mentioned demographics in Israel, and since you have a background in economics, I'd like to ask you a really big picture question, which hopefully I can articulate in just a few sentences. It seems to me that much of what happens in the world is driven by each country's foreign policy that is largely oriented toward making sure the resources flow to keep that economy going or booming or to grow it. It's clear in Gaza and many other places in the world, there are too many people consuming or wanting to consume too many resources, including in this country, including in China. What kind of threads do you see of the beginnings of people thinking, how do we run our economies locally up to globally so we aren't dependent upon increasing population growth to drive the economies and increasing consumption within each economy to drive the economy?
Right. Now, this certainly are big picture questions. And let me just speak from the Chinese perspective now, since, you know, they have the most people and the most leverage. Certainly on the force of population, that's been a gigantic issue in China with their one-child policy. And it just is, you know, that's having an obvious yet not fully anticipated effect. A combination of one-child policy and the very strong preference for males means you have, you know, in the overall population is something like 1.2 men to women. It looks in the population under about 12 years old, you hardly ever see a little girl on the street. You know, you see see little boys all the time, you just basically don't see little girls. And that's going to have some real impacts in the long run. So population growth, there is a predictable pattern around the world as societies modernize somewhat. You know, they're able to constrain that. And so the question, I guess, is whether the world can reach that turning point in time, you know, whether the 7 or 8 billion or whatever is going to be the peak level before things crest, whether that will be in time, which then leads to the resource point. On the one hand, China is amazingly frugal from the American perspective in the way resources are used. There's still zillions of bicycles, still zillions of little scooters. In Shanghai, new license plates for cars are auctioned off for a very high price. You got to get a license plate before a car, and you got to pay a lot of money to do it. On the other hand, you know, when you have 1.3 billion people, there's this huge, voracious appetite. And Beijing is so unbelievably polluted that I grew up near Los Angeles, and I'd never seen anything like what Beijing is like. So the question, again, with China is I think they are somewhat aware that everything that affects global warming and climate change is going to depend on, you know, very significantly on what they do in the next few years. And so how they can get enough energy without just building a zillion coal plants is a challenge. So these are big, big issues. I think most of the rest of the world is aware of them, converting them to what they do tomorrow. You know, the Chinese tomorrow, do they build another coal plant, or do they build a nuclear plant, which we also don't want? Or they build another Three Gorges Dam, which we also don't want? Or do they force more abortions, which we also don't want? So it's genuine dilemma. I think people are becoming aware, but they're very hard. So, yes, sir. Actually, you asked one before, so I'll have. Are you giving me the last question? So, yes. Why don't you choose? You can choose the people to ask the last question. Yes.
Yeah.
And I'll be happy.
I have to stay here.
I know. That's why you'll be especially wise in the choices you make. Yes, in the back. Yes. Sorry. Three different answers to that. First, Frank Rich is a really good friend of mine, and you can imagine the joy I had as the editor of the college newspaper when my reporting staff included Frank Rich and Mike Kinsley and Linda Greenhouse and Evan Thomas and Esther Dyson. I beg your pardon? It was great. So it's been all downhill since then. That was, you know, and Mickey Kaus was there too. It was Frank has become a real national treasure. Second, there has been a point I make about politics is that the Republicans have simply been better at it in the last generation than Democrats have. You know, they've had selling. Imagine if a Democrat were in office right now trying to sell this war. And trying to sell the budget deficit to. And simply they are better both in an admiring way and in a mean way. They're better at the 61 Yankees type of stuff. And that's as long as we have a competitive democracy, that matters. And the Democrats just have to do better, or the left has to do better. Finally, on whether was it pure politics, obviously Rove knew that security was always the strongest argument for Republicans, although you can question, you know, why it should be, but it has been. But I think that wasn't ultimately what drove the policy. I think ultimately what drove the policy, I think that George Bush believed what he said, what Paul Wolfowitz said, that this was their historic destiny to transform the Middle East and that he would be regarded in the future as Harry Truman was for the Marshall Plan. And so I think that was at the heart of it, what they think, and I think they were profoundly wrong, but in that one point, sincere. And I also am sincere in saying thank you all for coming here. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Rick Riley, Augustine Burroughs, Madeline Albright, Elizabeth Berg, Nando Parado, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on September 21st, 2006.